Hello, my name is Keith Paddle, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This particular week, I'm on vacation, if you like that. I'm on location, anyway. I'm in Houston, Texas. I'm at the Proton Therapy Center of the MD Anderson Cancer Center, and I'm going to be talking today, and you're going to be listening to Dr. Stephen Frank. He's the medical director of something called the Proton Therapy Center. Sounds very interesting. You know about protons from school, something to do with acidity. But what's that got to do with medicine? Well, we're going to find out that today. So, Stephen, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Before we get into the Proton Therapy Center and everything that goes with that, the physics a little bit later on maybe, but the medicine, tell us a little bit about Stephen. How did you become, I'm calling you a scientist, you know, you're a medical professional, you've gone through a science degree. How did you get into that as a way of a career?
So when I grew up, my father was a physician. He was a cardiologist, so I grew up in a home where medicine was part of our daily life. And ever since I was young, I always viewed that I would pursue a medical career and follow in the footsteps of my father.
Was there pressure to do that?
There was no pressure. There was no pressure, and you know, when I went to school and to university, I went to on a Navy ROTC scholarship. And so the Navy paid for college, and that was at the University of Pennsylvania. And after school, I had to make a decision about where I was going to go into. At that time, I wasn't ready to pursue a field of medicine at that moment, but I had taken all my medical requirements and had studied the biologies, organic chemistries, etc., while I was in school.
All the important courses.
And I ended up into the submarine naval nuclear propulsion program in the Navy. That's a program that required several years of schooling in nuclear physics, engineering physics, in reactor-based physics. And
what was your father's response to this? Did he say, "Oh, Stephen, where's he going?"
Yeah, they all thought that I had probably lost my mind. To go underwater for 7 months out of a year was not routine and normal,
right,
in our family.
These are important things because as people choose careers, quite often family input makes a difference. You know, do they sniff at this career or are they gung-ho?
That's right. Well, I think he was excited. We actually went down to Kingsland, Georgia, onto the USS Pennsylvania and toured it together. And it was after that tour that we saw the quality of the people in the submarine, and from a next step in a career pathway and to serve my time in the military, this was one of the most exciting groups of people to be around, with very exciting opportunities and missions that were all virtually unknown to people. And so I spent, you know, 5 years as my requirement was in the Naval Nuclear Propulsion Program. I was on the USS Batfish. It was a fast attack submarine initially based out of Charleston, and then South Carolina, and then they moved me up to New London, Connecticut, where I finished out my tour. And, you know, during the last year, after you're on the boat for several years, you go to Washington, D.C., to naval reactors, and you take your nuclear engineer's exam. And it's that examination that qualifies you as a nuclear engineer that allows you to continue to stay in if you choose. But I had also felt that I was ready to start looking at a medical career at that time, and had taken the MCATs and had decided to apply for medical school through the completion of my obligation.
So I mean, that's a very unusual background. I mean, nuclear engineer and submarines and then moving over to medicine. Tell me about, did you actually see any action? I don't know what action goes on under the water.
There's always action.
Right.
There's always action.
We did 150
or so missions on the 7-month deployment to the Mediterranean.
Okay.
And so we had a very exciting tour.
Right. It's interesting you say you go to the Mediterranean. So most people are going to think, oh, it's a lovely cruise. But I think under the water, especially, you wouldn't know where you were.
That's right.
Okay, so then you got into medicine, and then you went through a 5-year degree plan now for medicine.
Went to Emory University. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and got into Emory Medical School there, and
okay.
That gave me an opportunity to move back, you know, to where I grew up. went ahead and completed my four-year degree there. And during the third year of medical school, I was looking to find out what area of medicine may allow me to incorporate the engineering principles and the nuclear engineering principles, as well as bring that to medicine. And it was at that time that the field of radiation oncology came upon it. Okay. And it was virtually
a marriage in heaven, in a sense.
Well, there's not. That's right. I remember it was one of my my classmates who was a year ahead of me. He had just come back from doing a rotation and spending a month, in the practice of radiation oncology. And I had asked him, I said, "What is this field?" And he talked to me about it. And I went up to the library, started opening some textbooks on cancer and radiation oncology, and all the physics made complete sense to me. And it was...
You were one of the few, I'm sure.
Well, it was, because of my, right. because of my training. And I went to meet with some of the radiation oncology residents, and they said, "Welcome to the best-kept secret of medicine." It's great patient contact, high technology, opportunity to provide high cure rates and take good care of patients. So then I came out to MD Anderson. I went out to University of San Francisco in California, UCSF, to look at the different programs out there, and I got into the radiation oncology program here at MD Anderson and started that in 2001 through 2005.
And now you're the director of the Proton Therapy Center. That's pretty good. Tell the audience, what is radiation therapy? What is nuclear medicine?
So radiation therapy...
Big picture.
Yeah, big picture for radiation therapy. It's the ability to take energy, apply it to cancer cells, where the cancer cells lose the ability to multiply by having their DNA strands broken. And so it's the practical application of the use of energy that then breaks the DNA, the cancer cells can't grow, and they end up dying. So in essence, it's a technology that allows us to non-invasively treat cancer, kill the cancer cells, and then spare the normal tissues next to it.
I understand that in principle, all right? But I understand chemotherapy in principle, too. And there, the bottom line answer you usually get from professionals is cancer cells grow and reproduce faster. They have a bigger intake of energy needs and materials. And therefore, when you provide medicine, they get more of the nasty medicine than the healthy cells. And that causes them to die off quicker than at least that's the hope, than the healthy cell. I don't see the radiation and the same concept of the growth and the turnover quicker of the cells, making them pick on the cancer cells as opposed to the healthy cells. So could you address that a little?
Yeah, in fact, it does do that. So as a cell divides, it has to replicate its DNA. It has to then split into two different cells from one cell, and it goes through a standard cycle, a life cycle. And what we find is that cancer cells essentially are cells that have lost the ability to stop growing. So it's these cancer cells that continue to divide over and over and over that when you apply the high doses of radiation or the energy to it, then it's the cancer cells that more selectively get hit because they are actually dividing. And it's the grow as they develop the ability to continue to grow, that DNA gets exposed more to the high energy. And so essentially, those are the cells that become more targeted.
So any treatment that kills cells will automatically then be a cancer therapeutic agent, in the sense that since cancer cells are doing this turnover so quickly that no matter what the external energy is, you're going to have a curative possibility.
Potentially. Yeah. Right. And what makes radiation unique is that we're able to deliver it in ways that create what we call a therapeutic ratio. And what that basically means is that we know that normal tissues are going to be hit to some degree in addition to the cancer cells. And our job is to create enough radiation dose, meaning the number of total cumulative energy that we're giving, but at the same time, we do it over a protracted period of time because the normal tissue cells, when they get affected, they have normal repair mechanisms. The cancer cells lose their ability to repair themselves normally, and so they more selectively die. So what?
Why
your,
is that?
It's because it's their the properties of have been skewed by their malignant process.
So in general, cancer cells are less able to repair themselves, is what you're saying?
Correct.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here today in Houston, Texas at the MD Anderson Cancer Center, specifically at the Proton Therapy Center, talking to Dr. Stephen Frank, who is the medical director of that particular center. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neeson. I knew I shouldn't have given away that cat when my daughter was born.
What are you talking about, Dave?
A new study tells us babies exposed to allergens like cat dander before they turn one are less prone to asthma and allergies later. The key being that it has to be within the first year of the baby's life to see positive results.
Asthma has been rising since the early 1980s and is the most common condition in kids today. The worldwide sensitivity rates to one or more common allergens among school kids are approaching 50%.
Kids in homes with cat and mouse dander and cockroach droppings before turning 1 year old were far less likely to develop wheezing or allergies. And babies exposed to all three allergens fared better than those exposed to just two or one.
By age three, only 17% of kids exposed to all three had wheezing, compared to 51% of kids in clean homes. And kids exposed to both allergens and bacteria got the greatest protective effect.
The researchers believe infants' immune systems are stimulated in this unsanitized environment. Babies are also adopting beneficial bacteria, which may impact the development of their immune system.
This doesn't mean you should go get a cat just yet, because there could be other factors, including cigarette smoke or high stress. When we do uncover the causes of childhood allergies, imagine one day having a spray for your baby's crib to protect them against these illnesses. We are Drs. David Neeson and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell. I'm in Houston, Texas, at the Proton Therapy Center of the MD Anderson Cancer Center, which is, of course, part of the University of Texas. And we're talking to Dr. Stephen Frank, who is the medical director. And Stephen, you're pointing out that when you provide energy to cells, you can cause them to have significant damage. And the repair mechanism, if you like, for cancer cells is less effective than it is for regular cells, and that's the basis of all sorts of treatments, whether it be energy, whether it be chemotherapy or whatever. Now, people have heard about radiation, and they think X-rays, you know, and that's the sort of the jargon for that would be photons, right? But what we're doing here is you're bombarding people with protons. Now, this is a real species, right? This is not a waveform. This is a real particle. It's a hydrogen atom from which you've stripped the electron to give a little positively charged chunk of mass. How is this more efficient and more useful, perhaps, than, say, radiation, X-radiation?
What makes protons have its unique physical properties of protons? So what makes protons unique is that at high energies, it's able to go through normal tissue without delivering all of its energy or radiation, so to speak. And once, based on the energy, we can control the depth that the proton actually goes. And then once it hits to the tumor, we can have the energy deposited so that it hits the cancer. And then what makes it unique is that there's no additional protons that travel past that distance. So that's very different than photons, where photons, when it comes into tissue, into the patient, it reaches a maximum of energy within a certain distance of the tissue of the entry. And then it travels, hits the tumor, but also hits normal tissues along the way, and then it continues having with exit radiation. So what makes protons different than photons is that protons can be controlled in unique ways and they don't have any exit dose. And then it's taking each of the peaks that occur at the distal, at the end of the sort of range in which you've delivered the protons, and you create multiple peaks by changing the energy And that, in essence, allows you to cover the entire tumor. So what makes protons, you know, very exciting is that it is one of the most advanced forms of radiation, because you can deliver it to the tumor and not have any radiation past it.
And you can focus, in a sense, is what you're saying. And the focus is perhaps by energy, is that what I understood?
That's correct.
Right, so a little energy, you focus closer, more energy, you focus further back.
Exactly, and so we can control it
right.
Based on the energy levels.
I understand that for a static tumor, all right, you know, one little thing that you've got to focus on. Let's assume that you've got like a prostate that's got a little bit of cancer here, there, and everywhere. How do you handle that?
Well, in general, with prostate cancer, we treat the entire prostate. And so what we're doing is we're treating all of the tumors that are inside the prostate. Many men come in with, you know, several focuses of tumors, some on both sides of the prostate, some in the seminal vesicle, some that extends outside the prostate. And so we identify those through our imaging. We then identify the volume, the target volume that we're going to be treating, and then we plan to cover the entire target volume that there can be gross or microscopic disease.
Yeah, but in that case, does the prostate recover? The healthy cells? I mean, I don't think that's a fact, right? I mean, in this case, you're not just killing the cancer cells, as I understand it anyway. You're killing the whole shebang.
Well, the whole entire prostate is at risk. And what we are looking at doing, you know, one of the emerging technologies is trying to become more focal with, you know, the treatment of the prostate cancer so that we can hit the tumors and the dominant lesions utilizing MRI technology. However, that's an investigational element. And, you know, I think that the current view on prostate cancer, it is a multifocal disease. When we look at it and remove it surgically, we see small tumors that can be on both sides of the prostate. It's not just selected to one. However, there is, as we had PSA screening and we're catching cancers earlier and earlier, especially with lower grade, the concept of focal therapy is becoming more, you know, more investigated. And we actually have a focal protocol here with brachytherapy, which is an internal delivery of radiation as well. So
what does that mean?
Radioactive seeds.
Oh, yeah, sorry, but this is not the proton therapy.
Correct.
Right, the proton therapy, we'll come to that in a minute, that comes from your synchrotron or cyclotron down
there.
That's
right.
You have to sit at the end of a beamline in order to get treated.
Right.
Okay, so then I've got the picture, right? You've got this stream of protons, and you can vary the energy coming out of the cyclotron or the synchrotron. And so that tells you how deep you're going to go, right? What about moving tumors? I mean, you know, I've seen people around here who've got lung cancers, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, now here, you know, it's one thing to sit down and say you've got a lesion on your toe or keep your toe in the beam, and that's fine. But if you've got your lung, it's moving. Can you really do this business of focusing on a tumor that's moving? How easy is that to do? Is that a new area of study for you guys?
It is. I mean, we've been investigating this in the photon world for years, and we've started incorporating that into the proton world as well. I think what the different areas are ways in which we can track these tumors, utilizing and then turning on the beam when the tumor comes into the range by which we have planned it. So there's different ways to do that. One is a breath hold, where the patient holds their breath while the radiation is given.
It's a limited utility.
Then there's gating. Gating is when we monitor the breath, the patient's breathing, and that helps us monitor where the tumor is during that breath cycle. And then we can turn the beam on or off during the location and when the tumor is in the beam line.
So this, you have to have two foci. I mean, you have to have two ways of looking at this. You've got to be able to see the tumor by MRI, perhaps, and
or
the protons. Right, and then the protons are coming in, and so the one information is gated to the other. That's a pretty sophisticated.
And typically, you know, we also have the goal is to be able to utilize the patient's breathing cycle to do that. And these are technologies that we're incorporating into our proton facility that are very exciting. In fact, we're about to bring in a CT scanner to allow for in-room imaging so that the patient can have, you know, volumetric imaging of the lung and of the abdomen to provide three-dimensional information for more consistency and to reduce uncertainties.
Are there any secondary effects of the proton that you don't see with, say, photon radiation or chemotherapy? Is there any? It sounds very good. It sounds wonderful. Are there any features that we really don't understand yet, or is it now in a well established enough technology that we basically know what we're doing completely?
Well, proton therapy has been around for decades. It's been around.
It started in Loma Linda.
It was the hospital base that started in Loma Linda, but before that, you know, had Cal Berkeley. I mean, there were other facilities that were treating, but they were not in a hospital-based facility like Loma Linda. That was one of the first in 1990. And so we've learned a lot about protons. And what we have learned over the years is that there's different ways to deliver them. And so we have both here, we have an active scanning using magnets to be able to move the protons around and be able to deliver them in a very conformal way. We have passive scattering where we use different devices to help make the conform the beam to the tumor inside the body. So there are different ways that we are delivering it. We've published over 230 articles since 2006 when we opened up here. And we were the first in North America to utilize scanning beam. Scanning beam is the most exciting technology because it allows us to do intensity modulated proton therapy. And intensity modulated proton therapy is really one of the most advanced forms of the delivery of protons. We have initial NIH funded grant that just got renewed for another $20 million to help us identify and continue to evolve and expand this technology further and further. We're learning new opportunities with this technology every day. And here at MD Anderson, our goals are to define the role of proton therapy in every disease site. And so that's really what we are aiming to do strategically over the next several years, to be able to communicate to the world the value of proton therapy, when it should be used, when it should be not, and to look at the cost and comparative effectiveness with standard radiation.
A couple of points that come out of that. The first one is, of course, I look at you and I realize, just like me, you're a professor, right? You're in an academic institution. Does that have a bigger impact upon the way that this facility works than if it was just a private hospital, for example?
Absolutely. I mean, we have a discovery section, a translational section, and a clinical section. And everything that we do is taking discovery to the patient. We have an amazing physics group that is... I believe second to none. They're a group that really helps with the clinicians, with the dosimetrist. We have a team-based approach here that is really, it's exciting and it's unique. And it's this unique infrastructure that's allowed us to really accelerate the knowledge in our collaborations with other institutions that we have been, on these grants with, like Mass General. We are, in these grants with them. We've got more randomized trials here than we've ever had before. We'll have up to 8 that are comparing protons versus photons. I've opened up a head and neck randomized trial, and this trial is aiming to demonstrate that outcomes with proton therapy will be less toxic to patients with photon therapy and more cost effective.
I mean, that's an interesting point, that when you're going to do comparative, normally you have a positive impact, you have the new impact, and you have a placebo. Well, clearly placebos don't work in this game, but when you're beginning to get results and say, hey, this proton therapy far is superior to the photon therapy, when do you stop the experiment?
Well, that's what we have statistics. Yeah. And statistics help us to tell us what the primary endpoint is going to be looking at, when we would be able to achieve and reach enough events or have enough patients to be able to say, this is considered significant. We now can give you an answer.
So and stop the experiment.
And stop.
Do you have on-site ethicists?
Absolutely.
All
of this has to go through the internal review board of MD Anderson. So IRBs are the FDA's arms within academic institutions and other institutions to help make sure that this clinical studies that are run have appropriate consent and communicate to patients, what the potential advantages and disadvantages may be of being on that study.
And then the other issue that came up from your previous sort of discussion was there aren't many of these facilities around. I mean, I've seen people here from Denmark, from around the world coming here. More and more, I presume, there are going to be. I mean, in the United States, how many are there of these?
14.
14? Oh, that's already quite a large number.
Yeah, and there's another, dozen or so that are in the works for development.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting feature then, because when you see people coming from foreign countries, are these funded from funds as part of research programs that you have, or are these funded by independent insurance companies or governments abroad? What's your international posture, if I like?
No, I think that it's all the above. I mean, I think that ultimately every patient that comes in here, we try to put on prospective clinical protocols to evaluate, monitor how they're doing. We've treated over 5,000 patients since 2006, and it's very exciting because now not only have we excelled our knowledge in all the physics of proton therapy and the treatment delivery, we're accelerating our knowledge in disease outcomes, because what we ultimately want to be able to do is be able to help communicate who the right patients are that need access to this technology. We want to be able to demonstrate that the elimination of unnecessary radiation has significant effects. So, for example, in the oral cavity for standard radiation versus proton therapy, the elimination of that kind of radiation in the oral cavity itself can be equivalent to dental oral x-rays. So if I were to say to you, would you like for additional 10 oral x-rays be put in your mouth if they weren't necessary? Would that concern you?
Is that a question? Yeah. The answer is yes.
So 25 gray is a measurement that we use. What if I were to tell you that 5 million dental oral x-rays are equivalent to 25 gray? And that by using proton therapy, we could eliminate all that unnecessary radiation. And that unnecessary radiation causes patients to have mouth ulcers. It causes patients to lose their ability to taste. It causes patients to lose their ability to swallow.
And all of this is because the protons can be really delicately focused, and the normal photon radiation is much more diffuse.
Correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, the whole secret here, then, if it is a secret, it's no longer a secret because you're on Science Studio, is the fact that you can measure the distance within a body to wherever the particular tumor is, and then the physicists and the dosimetrists and all the other, and the computers. I mean, if you didn't have computers, right, this therapy would be really...
Well, that's why it's taken along. That's why it's so exciting now.
Right.
Because the technology is catching up.
What are your immediate goals? I mean, here you are. You're relatively young, and you're the medical director of the Proton Therapy Center, you know, a very famous center around the world, judging by what little I've seen since I've been here today. What are your personal goals?
Again, my personal goals are to help define the role of proton therapy so that we can communicate to policymakers, insurance companies, and help communicate what the value of it is so that patients can have access to this care. The goal is that in radiation therapy or any cancer care, the goal is to cure patients with the least amount of side effects. And if that's, you know, that is what we are aiming to do here, and I think that what gives us a unique opportunity is that we've got the infrastructure here to be able to treat patients on these clinical trials, be able to advance the technology, and be able to communicate with outcome-based research what the value of proton therapy is to the world.
Well, Stephen Frank, it's been fascinating. All the way from high school student, nuclear engineer in the Navy, now running this great center, the medical director of the Proton Therapy Center. I'd like to thank you very much for being here on Science Studio. It's been
great.
Thank
you. It's great to be here.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The Medical Center of the Americas Foundation and its Biomedical Innovation Institute, called Red Sky, are organizing Dynamica Expo. Last year known as Biomed, Dynamica Expo is El Paso's largest healthcare innovation conference. It's happening November 14th and 15th. Continuing education units will be offered. Register at dynamicaexpo.org. Dynamica's title sponsor is Sierra Providence Health Network.